And welcome back, Earth Explorer. Sorry about that. A minor technical difficulty. We can protect ourselves against earthquakes and tornadoes and electromagnetic pulses, but not the finger of two-year-olds. They will overcome everything. It's okay, though. She's going to have a great memory when she grows up, because Donald has a good record of this, and we'll all have a really pleasant time with it. Our call-in number, 877-876-5227, anywhere on the planet. We do want to recognize the BBS Radio Network coming to you from Paradise, California. They are responsible for handling our telephone calls, our archives, and maintain an excellent web page for us. And also the Global Star Radio Network, which many of you are listening to us on AM stations all around North and South America. We appreciate your patience, and now you know that all radio is not perfect. But we hung in there, and we're back. I wanted to mention, in my homeland of Scotland, there are lots of unexplained things. We have giant boulders, some of them weighing more than 1,000 tons, that are completely intact and sit in the middle of a grassy field hundreds of miles from their source. Now, these mammoth rocks are all over the place. How in the world did they get moved from their source to where they sit in this grassy field without shattering into gravel?
Okay, these are known as erratic boulders, and they're all over Europe and Russia, all over the world. And it was attributed to the Ice Age that they were carried by ice, melting ice sheets as they went across the continents. The problem with that theory is that in a lot of cases, in all cases, ice flows downhill. But a lot of these boulders have been taken great distances up and downhill and often placed on higher ground than their origins. And also they follow in patterns as if carried by water. And we believe, we haven't actually discussed at this point the Great Flood, but we believe that the Great Flood that occurred 5,000 years ago is responsible for shifting these boulders. And of course, like we were just talking about the Grand Canyon before, any inundation could be responsible for removing these boulders from great distances and dumping them in the middle of fields.
And one thing to remember as well, I mean, you're saying that they're all quite large, and why didn't they break up? Well, you can imagine a whole pile of rocks and boulders of all different sizes coming across the continent being carried by water. And once the water that's carrying them starts to subside and reduce in strength, drop the biggest ones first, and then if you travel along, you'll find that progressively you'll find smaller and smaller boulders and then eventually sand. And that's why you find only the biggest ones there. The ones that did break up actually continued to be travel with the water until further downstream or in the direction of the water traveling, and they will drop there together. And so you'll have a progression of the dropping of these boulders, and that's why they think they've been carried by water, because that's the only time you get that. If it was an ice age and an ice sheet, you'll have boulders of all sizes. You won't have that gradation of size.
Oh, that's exactly right. And can we tell, based on the heavy ones being dropped first and then the next and the next, which direction the flood was moving when it came through?
You certainly can. And of course, this will happen in different areas on the Earth, depending on where the flood is originating from. And of course, the flood has gone in two directions as well. The flood first came out onto the surface of the planet, and then that's the direction in one way. And then when the water subsided, it's going in the opposite direction. So you do have a bit of a muddled effect of both directions. But, of course, when you do see that gradation, that is a very good indication of the direction of that the water was traveling at that time.
And you did mention that glaciers cannot flow uphill. I'm sure that really makes a lot of geologists upset.
That's right. We also have score marks and scrapes on flat ground, and that also can't happen with glacial action, because when they have studies, for example, in Antarctica, there's huge flat areas of ground covered with ice, and they've discovered that the ice actually protects the ground. It doesn't actually carve it. The ice isn't moving in any direction. It actually protects it.
Mm.
And so there are instances where glaciers moving downhill will score and carve out U-shaped valleys, but on flat ground, these carvings in the ground are obviously from boulders being washed along and scraping more so than ice ages and glaciers. That doesn't seem to be a proper way of explaining it.
Glaciers move through gravity, and gravity taking the ice downhill. When it's on level ground, it's basically got nowhere to go, and so it's stationary. And this is the problem with a lot of these markings. They're on totally flat ground.
I would think that high-velocity water carrying a lot of grit and gravel could leave very similar markings.
That's right.
That's what we believe to be correct. It's just that without the expanding hollow earth theory, there isn't a reason for a great flood unless it's inundation. But with a hollow planet, there is reason for pressure differences inside the planet and ocean level differences inside the planet locked inside, which would give good reason for the Great Flood and also the floods that we're now seeing on Mars.
Well, you know, you mentioned the Flood of Noah, the Great Flood. Many people look around and they see mountains and they see vast deserts and they say, is there really enough water on the earth to have flooded everything the way the flood is described in, say, in the Bible?
This is one of the things that started the Land of No Horizon off. The big problem with our biblical understanding of the flood, for me, was not only where did the water come from, but where did the water go to after flood for the land to reappear? It can't just simply dry up. But in actual fact, the flood waters came from the inside of the planet, and this is a natural evolutionary process of planets, and it's happened on Mars too. And if we look at that, the way to look at it just briefly is outgassing, which is all the gases coming from volcanic activity on the outer surface of the Earth has created our atmosphere, and the moisture has created our oceans. This has come out of the mass of the planet. If you have a hollow planet, the same thing will happen on the inner surface. We'll have outgassing and we'll have oceans. But there's a difference. On the outside of the Earth, there's two different factors that fall into place. First one is, above the surface, you've got an increasing area, so the ocean spreads out thinner and thinner, whereas inside the Earth, above the surface, you've got a decreasing area, so mass builds up deeper. The same amount of outgassing produces a deeper ocean. The second thing is that we've got solar wind. Now, the Earth can only hold so much atmosphere. Once it is fully, once it contains its full amount of atmosphere, the solar wind removes any excess atmosphere. So the atmosphere of the Earth can only be so much.
Because there's only so much gravity on the Earth.
Because there's only so much gravity on the Earth to hold the atmosphere in place. That's right, Matthew. But inside the Earth, there's no solar wind to blow off the atmosphere. So outgassing just increases and increases and increases until the atmosphere reaches the very center of the planet. Then you have a situation where you've got an imbalance between the oceans and atmosphere inside the Earth and outside the Earth. Now, as the Earth expands and the planetary wall becomes thinner, then once that breaks through, say, through a celestial impact, or as biblical texts tell us, we were warned of this flood, that it was instigated, then the inside atmosphere pushes out all this ocean to the outside, flood the whole world. Once the inner atmosphere has escaped, as the great wind over the Earth is described in Genesis, then the water can then return and balance inside. So what actually happens is the ocean level rose, flooded all the lowlands of the world, and of course the people of those days thought the whole world was flooded, but they didn't even know the world was round, so they couldn't see the other side. Once the atmosphere was able to escape from the Earth, then the floodwaters were able to flow back in. Now these floodwaters would have flow across areas and created things like the Grand Canyon, Fraser Island, Australia, the biggest sand island in the world. The sand comes from 1,000 kilometres away down in, it was probably about 1,300 kilometres away down west of Sydney.
And also these boulders that you were talking about earlier, they're all examples of this massive amounts of water that were cascading across the continent.
And there's a lot of new things too now. Once the ocean waters flow back into the Earth, then the sediments settle down to the centre of gravity, which is in the low parts of the ocean where the holes were through to the inner world, and that produces a fault sea floor,
And when currents flow through these areas, then you get anomalies on the surface of the sea, on the outside or the inside, if you have currents flowing through these areas, which we need. There's just not enough time in 3 hours to go through it all.
Right, and so the water came from the interior of the Earth, and I guess it would only take a few inches of water pressure to for that much water to come out with fairly good force. 300 or 400 miles an hour should do it. How high did the water get around the planet moving that quickly?
Well, there's a few things to think about. I mean, the flood occurred 5,000 years ago. I'm not exactly sure the height that it reached. Certainly leveled with the Mount Ararat, which apparently where the ark rested on. So that's certainly a feasible height. We're talking about almost doubling the size of the ocean or more. Another thing to think about as well, there's lots of evidence of the ocean changing in depth during the flood, and that's one of the causes of the ice age, is they're trying to explain how the ocean changed in depth, because there's such a lot of evidence that the ocean used to be a lot shallower in the past.
Mm-hmm.
For example, quite a lot of rivers, when they come up and reach the delta at the ocean, if you actually do depth soundings, you actually find there's a river still travelling on the continental shelf, and then it actually ends a lot further out. In lots of places, and this is because the ocean was much shallower in the past.
One thing that they found is that the Thames River in London, the Rhine River in Germany, actually joined together on the continental shelf in the North Sea.
And then jointly flow into the Atlantic.
They found the forests on the seafloor 34 metres below the surface, oak, and their roots are still intact in the ground, but they've all been pushed over. We found ruins beneath the sea level, and perhaps, you know, Atlantis may have been a great city that was on the mid-Atlantic ridge that's been flooded, but there's definite proof that the sea level has risen. But to have said it's from melting of ice, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support that.
So one of the things we should mention here is why we think the ocean level is now deeper. Now, in the past, when the Earth was smaller in diameter and it was spinning fast, as we explained before with the dinosaurs, there was less gravity on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So the Earth was able to hold on to less atmosphere, and because it was holding on to less atmosphere, the ocean levels were shallower. Now, as the and of course the solar wind has blown off any excess atmosphere because the gravity can't hold on to it. So as the Earth has expanded, it's actually reduced the centrifugal force, and the gravity is now stronger. So the potential for holding more atmosphere is greater. Okay, now that sort of set the time before the flood. When the flood occurred, the excess atmosphere came out from the inside, on flooded the outside, and then partially returned. And now, because the gravity is stronger as a result around equatorial regions and many parts near the equator, you can actually hold more atmosphere, and now, as a result, we actually have deeper oceans. Any excess atmosphere was still blown off by the solar wind, but the resultant is we now have more ocean and more atmosphere than before the flood, and this is quite easily shown when we see the difference in height of the oceans.
So the atmospheric pressure inside the planet dropped.
Definitely. And it now should be about the same as what we'd expect on the outside, although it's been 5,000 years since the flood. And, of course, we'd expect that the pressure will continually build inside the planet. But now that there are these holes through the wall, once it gets to a certain amount of pressure, which it wouldn't be anywhere near the amount before, it will start to leak out through these faulty floors.
We'll talk a
little
bit.
This is why I think the source of the polar hole, we can't actually prove that there is a hole at the North Pole, but there is evidence of warm sea currents and pollens and tropical sort of pollens in the water there. And if we are to believe in the Genesis side of things, where Noah was warned and the flood was cut through the wall, then you could understand a situation where to evenly disperse the flood, there would have been locations all over the world where it was cut through, one of these being, and of course the geoid will tell us where these locations would be, because it would be where the geoid is low.
Sure.
And therefore, these openings would have been cut at various places. This is where, it's very hard to prove a lot of things, but it all fits, and this is where it's worthy of investigation. Some of the strange phenomenon in the Bermuda Triangle, for instance, whether we believe it or not, it can be answered by these false sea floors creating currents and vortexes and so on.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about polar openings in our third hour. I've got a pretty interesting expedition I want to run by you. So you're saying that this flooding process, if there is water on the interior of a planet, is a process of natural evolution of the planet.
Yes.
And you're saying that that Mars had a great flood as well?
That's exactly right. Now, one of the things with Mars, it's sort of in between the size of the Earth and the Moon. Now, we know that the Earth has a certain level of gravity and it's able to hold on a certain amount of atmosphere.
Right.
We know that the Moon, its gravity is about 1/6 that of Earth, and it's actually not strong enough to hold an atmosphere on. The solar wind blows off any potential atmosphere and it's going in lost space. Now, Mars is somewhere in between, and we find that the atmosphere on Mars is about 1/100th the pressure of the atmosphere on Earth.
That's right.
Now, that pressure presents a problem. Well, there's been obviously lots of rovers and so on around on Mars at the moment, and there's proof without a doubt that Mars was flooded, and a great percentage of the surface of Mars has been underwater. But they can't understand how the water could be there. And the reason why is because the atmospheric pressure is too low. If we were to have a glass of water, say, on Mars, it would boil away to gas because the pressure is not great enough to keep it as a liquid.
Yeah. So the other reason is there's no water there now. So
that's right. Now, the floods of Mars are quite exciting when we think about what's happening. Now, we know that Mars has a magnetic field and that the process of Mars is very similar to what we believe the Earth happened on the Earth. It's very similar in the orbit in the solar system, so the makeup of the planets is very similar. Just the size is pretty much the difference. Now, we believe that the outgassing that occurred on Mars, obviously most of it was blown away by the solar wind on the outside of the planet, but like the Earth, on the inside, it's built up to a higher pressure, and this allowed liquid water to form. Now, eventually, at some point in the past, there was a celestial impact or something fractured the shell of the Earth, and this water was then allowed to, pressure was allowed to escape. Now, what's actually happened is the water then escaping under pressure onto the surface of Mars has carried with it all the sediments as it's broken through the shell, and it's dumped them all on the outside. Now, as this water's rushing out into this lower atmosphere, then very quickly, the water starts to boil away into gas, and of course it can't hold the sediment anymore, and it drops the sediment onto the ground. So we have these massive big clogs of sediment found on the surface of Mars. Now, we know that Olympus Mons is the largest volcano in the solar system, and it's tremendous in size compared to anything we've seen on Earth. And it's quite different in structure to what all the volcanoes are on Earth as well. When we have a look at Olympus Mons on Mars, it's a massive big flat pancake of a structure. If we look at the really close-up imagery of the actual center of this volcano, if we can call it a volcano, it is all sandy in origin and has little slip marks and little pools. And it doesn't have a conical structure like this, the normal structure of a volcano. Now, this structure also occurs in the lowest area of the planet, which is the northern hemisphere of Mars, which is the most logical place for a breakthrough the planetary shell to occur and for the flooding to occur. So what's actually happened is there's another structure as well. The northern part of the planet tends to be quite devoid of craters, and then the south part of the planet, which is generally a lot higher, has a lot more impact marks. Now what's actually happened is one of the impacts has fractured the wall. The pressure has started to force out the water, and as the water is forced out, it's carried sediment with it, and it's built up this massive big plug of Olympus Mons on the surface. And it actually has flooded the surface at the northern part of the planet, and it's eroded away all of this impact evidence. So that's why we see that there's no impact on the northern part of the planet, or very few, only recent ones.
Now, did the water return to the interior of Mars after the flood?
It may have done a little bit, but what would generally happen, and what's more likely, is the water would just boil away straight away and then blow off by the solar wind in space.
Well, the solar wind is quite a bit weaker.
Is when the water came out in large volumes, initially it would have provided an atmosphere as it boiled and probably kept the oceans liquid for a lot longer, because it would take a certain amount of time for the solar wind to blow the excess atmosphere off.
Right.
But there's a couple of other really interesting points here too, Brooks, and that is some of the latest photos of NASA of some of these drainage networks, actually they're so fresh and so sharp, and there's even dark sand in the bottom of them that they actually feel now that the water is still seeping to the surface. Now, if water is still seeping, they can't explain this because they don't understand the hollow planet theory, an expanding planet theory. But there are a couple of things here. One is there is a magnetic field emanating from the center of Mars, and we need to talk about the magnetic field too later on. The thing is that for water to be coming out of Mars, we know there has to be atmosphere to create liquid water, and there has to be sufficient heat inside Mars, which we talk about the magnetic field being the heat source in the center of the planet. To keep the water as liquid, there has to be a heat source, there has to be an atmosphere. Now, if you've got heat source, atmosphere, and water, you've got the elements for the evolution of life.
I guess you do.
And so we have to question what would we find inside Mars. And if the water is still coming to the surface, as is indicating with the clarity of these drainage networks and so on, the sharpness of edges, then it would indicate that there is water still present inside Mars, atmosphere still present inside Mars, and there's the possibility of life inside Mars is the question. Again, that's why we need to investigate these things, because the evidence, it's almost damning the evidence.
So if we have a source of energy in the center of the Earth, let's just say, we're talking about an outer crust. We've established that's formed, and it's somewhere between, 600 and 800 miles thick?
The crust, the shell of the Earth, we imagine would be about 250 miles thick.
250 miles.
If you join all the continents together and you add up the surface area of a smaller Earth and calculate the volume, and then you take that volume and spread it out so it fills the Earth today, you'll find that it'll be about 400 kilometers thick or 250 miles thick in the shell.
Okay.
And that seems to work fine with the ship's seismology as well.
All right, so if we're looking at the diameter, then that's 500 miles, and the Earth is about 7,200 miles thick, somewhere in there. That leaves about... That leaves about 5,700 to somewhere around 6,500 miles of diameter unaccounted for.
That's right.
Now, our atmosphere above us is somewhere around, I'd say about 50,000 feet usable atmosphere, and then beyond that, let's put it this way, the space shuttle flies at about 240 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So that's outer space to us. There is no outer space in the interior of the Earth, right?
What will actually happen, the closer you get to the center of the planet, the less gravity is. So you'll find that atmosphere will cut right across, but it will be very rarefied in the center.
So in the interior of the Earth, we've got somewhere around 6,000 miles of atmosphere from one side to the other. And in the middle of this atmosphere, insulated by all this air, is some energy source, a light source, let's say.
Yes. We've actually had some recent discoveries on this, which I think you'll find quite exciting. Basically, when we analyze the sun and the magnetic field coming from the sun, what's generally accepted is that some kind of fusion reaction that's causing the sun. Fusion is where you actually get light elements and you actually combine them together to create a heavier element, and in return you actually get energy from that. Now, if you actually think about the actual center of the planet and the atmospheres, the type of environment that we have there. Now, effectively, we've got all different types of gases that make up the atmosphere on the inside. And what we'll find, because there's more gravity near the inside shell, then you'll have more gravity there, and you'll have the heavier gases near the ground. And then the higher up you go, you'll have lighter and lighter elements. Now, in the center of the planet, you'll find that you'll have hydrogen, because hydrogen is the lightest element, and it'll get pushed to the center. And what we find, hydrogen is the main thing that we use when we're trying to emanate the fusion.
Sure, because it's the heaviest proton.
Yeah, so basically, what actually happens, you've got a quite an interesting structure here. Now, We know that in the actual body of the planet, in the actual mass, in the rock, we have lots of radioactive elements and radioactive decay, and this is energy that's being emanated from the actual mass of the planet. On the surface, on the outside, it just emanates off into space, so we don't even notice it here on the surface. But on the inside, we find that there's a natural focusing. So in the center of the planet, you have all this radioactive decay focusing on the center, and it's focusing on the hydrogen in the center. Now, this is exactly what's required for a fusion reaction. We have hydrogen, we have an energy source which breaks down the elements, and joins the elements together and causes a fusion reaction, and that actually ends up with helium. You don't actually end up with, the beauty with a fusion reaction is you don't end up with anything radioactive as a byproduct. A byproduct happens to be heat and magnetic field and radiation in all different, and light, of course, in all different spectrums. And this is the perfect example of what's actually happening and what's causing the magnetic field. Now, for a long time, we've tried to understand what's causing the magnetic field in the center of the Earth and in all planets. And the current theory is the dynamo theory. Now, there's a lot of evidence, a lot of information about the magnetic field that we have, and the dynamo theory just does not explain it. For example, we know that the magnetic field is not exactly lined up with the rotational axis of the planet. It's actually off by a number of degrees, and in some planets it's off by almost 90 degrees. So any mechanism inside the center of the planet that's causing it some kind of dynamo effect, it has to be nullified if it's off on an angle.
That assumes that both bodies, the one in the middle and the crust, are rotating on the same axis. If the central body is rotating at a much denser fashion, rotating in a different direction than the crust, then the magnetosphere is going to line up with the poles of the central body and not the crust.
That's right. So the possibilities are, in order to solve that problem in the current model, is that the core of the Earth is actually turning at a different angle to the rest of the Earth. But one of the problems with that is that if you've got one body turning in relative to something else, you've got friction. And the Earth's been around for 4,000 million years, and that's just way too long for this to still be taking place.
Unless you have air as a dielectric, then there wouldn't be any, well, there'd be very little friction. It certainly wouldn't work with a molten core.
Another one of the problems is, another theory, part of the dynamo theory, is that there's maybe convection currents in a molten liquid center, and this is a possibility for how it could be generated as well. But of course, we know that in the center of the planet, there is almost no gravity, and when there's very little gravity, there is not enough. You can't have a convection current because that relies on a gravitational field for the convection to work. So this is another thing that's not quite explainable. There are other things as well. For example, the north magnetic pole does not line up with the north pole of the rotation. It actually wanders around the northern part of the planet. It's never in the same spot, and it goes in quite a weird pattern. It tends to go in spirals, and these spirals tend to migrate westward around the planet. And it's a very slow process, but they don't understand that whatever is causing magnetic fields tends to be disconnected somewhat to the outside of the planet, and it tends to be constantly on the move. The other thing we know as well is that from time to time, the magnetic field reverses in polarity, and this really doesn't make a lot of sense in the dynamo theory. Whatever is generating it, you'd expect that it would stay generating that way. Where does this force come from to flip the magnetic field?
It does fit.
When you think about it in terms of a hollow planet theory, all these oddities are very easy to explain. So if you imagine, let's explain how the flipping works. If you have a fusion reaction in the center of the planet, and this fusion reaction causes a magnetic field, and what's actually happening, the magnetic field is it's not that strong, but we can detect it on the outside, and it travels right through the whole planet. Now, when two continents are moving apart from each other, a new oceanic floor is being created in between, this rock, as it solidifies, it locks in this magnetic alignment.
That's right.
This is why we know that the pole has flipped so many times in the planet's history, because we have areas where the ocean floor has got north polarity and south polarity and north polarity and south polarity all the way along, and it keeps flipping one way or the other. Now, the reason why this happens is we have the central fusion reaction in the center of the planet, and as this rock and everything has been solidifying in different parts around the world, it's actually locking in this magnetic alignment that actually matches the magnetic alignment of the central sun. So what actually happens is all the areas around the planet are mimicking the north and south that is currently in the actual central sun. Now what happens is the magnetic field is not very strong, so it's actually quite weak in the scheme of things. And as the planet starts to build up a pattern of the same north and south that mimics the sun, gradually, this, as more and more rock solidifies and locks in the magnetic field, it gradually builds up, and as we know, north and north repel, and north and south attract. So eventually what happens is, the north pole of the central sun is actually pointing towards an area of the Earth which is now becoming north, and increasingly more and more north, until it gets to a point where north and north repel each other, and all of a sudden, it'll flip the magnetic field, and it will swap to the other direction, and the north pole will then point to the south pole, and then the south pole points to the north pole. And this is the mechanism that's occurring.
Would
and
that
of course,
be,
quite a stable structure.
Would that be cataclysmic for surface dwellers?
No, because it's just the magnetic field that's changing, and it's just flipping, and there's nothing more than that. And once it flips, it'll fit in perfectly opposite to what it has been, and then it'll slowly start changing it back the other way. And this process takes 11,000 years or whatever it is. It's quite a long time.
Well, I find this is absolutely fascinating, and I want to talk more about the internal sun, about maybe how it can foster life, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about what life is like on the inside of the Earth. My guests tonight are Kevin and Matthew Taylor. They are the authors of a great book, The Land of No Horizon. You can get it by going to hollowedearththeory.com or by going to xsquaredradio.com. And don't forget that our call lines are open, 877-876-5227. And we're going to take about 6 minutes break, and we will be back right after these messages. I'm Brooks Agnew, and this is X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moon walk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are we are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
You know, thus is the place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family pardon that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio.
People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique. Give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public land somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world, and because of their love for the earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person.
The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the space store at X Squared Radio.
Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas, to fish, to eagles, to horses, in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today.
Welcome back, Earth Explorers. Brooks Agnew here. Wanted to let you know that this program does run for 3 hours. This is the third hour. If your radio station doesn't carry all 3 hours, make sure to send us their call letters and we'll take the rest. We will make sure that they start carrying all 3 hours for you, because this is the fastest 3 hours in radio, and we cover a lot of neat scientific stuff here. You know, we explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth, and we want to let you know that through our BBS radio network that our phone lines are open, 877-876-5227. Also wanted to let you know next week that Dr. Stephen Greer will be on the program, and we will be talking about the Disclosure Project and his new book. We don't want you to miss that program at all. I did have one more question, actually lots more questions for our guests. But we were talking about the Hollow Earth Theory and the fact that the accumulation of hydrogen in the center of the Earth, the addition of radioactive. What I mean by radioactive, I mean gamma radiation. That is actually an excellent compressive force that we use in fusion reactions right now on the Earth. Of course, the only thing we really know how to use them for effectively is weapons, but hopefully one day we'll begin to learn to use them as an energy source. There is no radioactivity from that reaction. For those of you trying to figure out how that happens, hydrogen is the heaviest proton in the chart, and as the two protons come together and form a helium atom, the protons lose a little tiny bit of mass. Well, that mass times the speed of light squared is the energy that's given off that we see as sunlight. And we use it to, well, it's actually the source of all life on the surface of the planet. So if there's a reaction going on like that in the center of the planet, it's going to be the source of all life on the center of the planet. But we're going to talk a little bit about that life, and a little bit more about the sun and the atmosphere, and hopefully you'll get a very clear picture of what this is like. One question I wanted to ask is, does the size of the inner solar body, let's just call it the inner sun, does it increase with the size of the planet? As the planet is continually expanding, does the sun inside of it expand?
Yes, we believe it does, and we believe the process of all planets is related to this. For example, if you go to Mercury, they can actually detect the heat coming from out the center of Mercury. And if the planet reaches a certain size, the fusion reaction consumes the matter of the planet into plasma and produces a star. So it's a effectively, what's actually happening is when you detect a planet's magnetic field, that's an indication of how strong that central solar reaction is, the fusion reaction. Obviously, Earth has quite a strong magnetic field. So we assume that the central sun is quite large. Mars has one, but it's a lot weaker. But it's obviously enough to provide enough heat to keep the water bodies on the inside of the planet liquid, because we know that there's been a flood on Mars. When we look at the sun, it has an absolutely massive magnetic field. And what's actually happened is it's starting to consume the actual matter that makes up the hollow portion of the sun, because we believe, of course, that the Earth is said that the sun is hollow as well. And it actually turns the mass part of the sun into just a huge, big, molten mass, and actually gives off light and heat, which is what, of course, we see here on Earth as the brightness from the sun.
Excellent information. We do have a caller on the line. Caller, can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Hi, Brooks. This is Al from New York.
Hi, Al.
I am finding your guests very interesting in the topic tonight. I have a question. If a team of individuals were going to go down and explore the center of the Earth, how far would they get down before the atmosphere would affect them? Aside from bringing maybe a set of sunglasses, how far would they be able to go down?
You're talking about the atmospheric pressure?
Yes.
You mean if we went through a crustal opening into the interior of the Earth, say we were on a ship and we were sailing on the ocean and we sailed through some corridor into an inner sea, do you think we could make it all the way to the inner crust?
I think that the atmosphere wouldn't reach all the way through. There would have to be water, and there would have to be perhaps sediment as well that you'd have to travel through to get through to the inside. If we were to imagine that that wasn't there and we did have atmospheric pressure all the way down, I would imagine it would be quite a lot deeper. But if a portal was open and the atmosphere was flowing all the way through, then you would imagine that the pressure would not vary very much. You wouldn't have to go through a depth. It was an opening all the way through. But if it was just a depth of solid atmosphere, it would get more and more compressed, the atmosphere. But as you're passing through this area, your body is gradually adjusting to that inside and out. If you were suddenly put in high pressure situations, you'd be crushed. But if you're gradually going into that, I would imagine that your internal pressure would equal your external pressure, a bit like the bends when you come out of deep water.
Also as well, if you do cross the center of gravity through the wall of the planet or the shell of the planet, then you'll you'll start to reduce in weight, and you'll notice that everything is getting lighter as the closer you get to that point.
Yeah, the human body can withstand easily 3 atmospheres and can go all the way down to about 1/3 of an atmosphere as long as the change is pretty gradual.
That's right, yeah.
That's right. That's what we believe. And I guess these sort of things have never been properly tested yet. There may be some aspects that we are not quite aware of, but that's what we would tend to support, yes.
Does that answer your question, Al?
Yeah, it was a little hard to understand because I'm on the phone, but I'll listen to the rebroadcast. And Brooks, I appreciate you taking my phone call today.
No problem. We're glad you're on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, take care now.
Thank you. So when the solar body on the interior of a planet gets to a certain size, then the reaction literally just consumes the crust, and then you have a star.
Yes, that's right. And you'll find that there's a lot of heat generated from such a reaction, as well as light and magnetism and all different sorts of radiation. And this has to escape. And, of course, inside a planet, perhaps the size of Earth, it's enough to keep the inside quite warm. But eventually, if you get a bigger and bigger planet, you've got more and more radioactive decay, which is focusing on the center, and you'd expect the reaction to be much larger and producing a lot more heat, and effectively it will start to consume a planet much quicker. So you'd expect something like the Sun, or even Jupiter has a large magnetic field, and we know if that was 100 times larger, it would be the Sun itself.
Sure.
So we can sort of see the scale there from something like the Moon, which I don't think has any magnetic field at all, and then we've got Mars, which has a small one, and Earth, and then moving up, and then eventually we've got Jupiter, which has a large one, and we can detect the heat coming from within the planet. And then we go up to the Sun, and obviously that's much larger still, and the heat is actually so strong that it's actually turning the mass of the planet, if we can call it a planet, into a molten material.
Mm-hmm. Well, assuming the solar mass inside our planet is just the right size, just as our planet seems to be just right in so many other respects, then there must be life inside of our world.
Right. One thing we can't be totally sure of is the level of heat reaching the inner surface. But there are certain points in evidence that gives us ideas. But if we imagine the makeup of the planet on the outside as is sufficient for life to evolve, why not life on the inside? But there's some interesting differences on the inside of the planet. For instance, on the outside, we have to contend with, your summer and our winter, or night and day, different climatic conditions. Whereas on the inside, there's no today, tomorrow, or next day. It's all just one long, warm day. And so life evolving inside the planet would be less complex. Therefore, there's a situation that perhaps it may advance much faster than life on the outside surface that has to contend with all these changing conditions.
I would also imagine that things that fly would be able to fly much higher because there's no actual thinning of the atmosphere like similar to what there would be in our atmosphere. You can only fly maybe a little.
It would still thin, but not at the same rate. It's certainly thin
exactly.
At the slower rate.
And there's another factor too that inside a hollow planet, and we haven't got really time to go through this. Gravity would be less. So if a bird is to fly, it would fly with less effort.
Wow.
Because gravity is less, the animals, species, plants, everything can be much finer. We're not necessarily supporting UFO. At this point, but it's interesting to see that they're always very fine-boned and so on. But there's another side to this as well, and that is we have a missing link, which is recognized in scientific circles. We're trying to find a connection with man's evolution from the apes, and we can clearly see that we are connected to them genetically, but there are some evolutionary gaps that just seem to be missing. For example, if you take, say, a simple bird, there are thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of species of birds that have all evolved on the same level, whereas humanity is totally alone. But there's also some other problems with humanity, too. There are certain parts of us that don't seem to match the environment where we live. For example, if you compare us to other animals and primates our size, our bone structure is much less. We have less protection from heat and cold and sunlight. We don't have as much pigment in our skin for most of us. And our eyes are affected by UV light. But really interesting thing is this, that we're alone with our intelligence and we're alone with our 28-day reproduction cycle.
Yeah, I was going to say, we ovulate quite a bit different than other life.
All the characteristics of humans must have come from somewhere. Why are we different from the rest of life? And if we examine the inner environment of the Earth, it is an environment that would actually produce all those unique characteristics, such as finer bone. And one really interesting thing is that in the inner Earth, there is no time. But yes, there is. The inner Earth world is affected by the orbiting moon, which means that the only movement inside the Earth would be the tidal movement, and of course that would affect the atmosphere as well, because it's a gravitational force. So life would roll along in a 28-day cycle in the inner Earth, and we have that. All humanity has that. Whereas life on the outside Earth is aligned with seasons, or perhaps in the deserts where the rain comes, but here our reproduction cycle is one that aligns with the cycle, it's an equivalent cycle to the moon. And so in our intelligence, and if we look at the inside environment of Earth, and it's suitable for the evolution of life, one could possibly imagine that in the inner world, intelligence would have been reached sooner in the evolutionary cycle than it would be on the outside world.
You would
and
think
does
so,
this
because
provide some answers? Have we missed the most exciting thing in human history?
Yeah, you would think that life would develop to intelligent levels and not fall to levels of extinction, because we don't have these Darwinian events happening on the inside of the Earth like we do on the outside.
That's right. They're largely protected from celestial impact. And, of course, you know, if there's clouds in space blotting out the sun and so on, that's never going to happen on the inside. So
sure,
there's all these different things, and it's a lot more protected on the inside. Of course, we do know in 5,000 years ago, the pressure inside the Earth has dropped considerably as the flood occurred. And this is probably one of the most remarkable changes that's happened on the inside of the Earth since its beginning.
Do you think that these interior dwellers have been around longer than surface dwellers?
Yes. Again, we subscribe to the thought that there is so much evidence on this and the results could be so amazing that we should investigate it. We have texts that tell us of the creation of humanity. Now, whether you're religious or not, whether you follow religions or whether you don't, or whether you fit it as a historian book, or is it up to each individual person? What's really interesting is, as you would have seen in the Land Under Horizon, how this relates to the creation of humanity, offers an answer to our origins, where we came from.
And also to the flood and so on as well. It actually puts a lot of scientific evidence behind a lot of things that we read about in the Bible.
Well, when you look at the observations that whoever actually wrote the manuscripts that we got the Bible from, or at least pieces of the Bible from, you see their observations in the best language that they had at the time, and their symbolism and their set of mores that they had at the time. But it's pretty clear that by the time you get out of the book of Genesis, you've been introduced to five different races of beings. You've witnessed the birth of a planet that's so similar to mitosis of a cell, it isn't funny. And, intergalactic travel, all in the book of Genesis, in pretty plain and simple language.
And we mustn't forget the very first words of the Bible, which are, "In the beginning the earth was void and darkness was on the face of the deep." So effectively the very first sentence of the Bible actually describes the earth as being hollow.
Exactly. It also describes it as having no sun and no moon till about the third day.
That's correct. And the two great luminaries, we assume one to be the moon and one to be the sun, but in actual fact, the two great luminaries we feel are one inside the Earth and one the sun itself.
Yeah, but the actual term luminary means giving off light, whereas the moon doesn't actually give off light, it actually reflects light from the sun.
That's
so if you want to really stick to the strict meaning of what a luminary is, it's a light source. and the moon doesn't qualify as that. But the central sun, of course, and the outer sun both qualify as luminaries, and these would match up perfectly with what is mentioned in the Bible, is the large luminary and the smaller luminary.
Do you think Noah came from the center of the earth?
Noah, did you say?
Yeah.
We believe when we wrote that part of it, that Noah was a slightly more advanced race of people that were selected to continue on. As humanity was created, there were refinements made. For instance, with Adam and Eve was brought to Adam because Eve needed to refine Adam to a higher race. And Noah was this. Noah lived for 600 years, but it wasn't Noah, it was a race of people. And they were the ones, the perfected ones, that were actually saved from the Great Flood. And they repopulated the world because, obviously, the people who evolved inside the earth eventually found the outside. But they would have found the environment out here very harsh, gravity very heavy, the sunlight and so on. And so we believe that gives reason for the creation of a race of people that could live on the outside that they could control, which, and they were given text, which is the biblical text, and this is where it all comes from. And the Great Flood was, the planet was in imbalance, and once the flood happened naturally, say through a celestial impact, it could have caused devastation to the inner and outer world. So they decided, that we believe, the logical way is that they decide to bring the flood on and put the world into balance. And that's why we have this thing that the promise of never being this inundation event ever again.
Well, the Bible does clearly state that the flood of Noah was not accidental, that it was deliberate and it was delivered and it was caused. Whether we agree with the reason why it was done is irrelevant. The fact that it was known that it was going to happen and that it was going to be delivered as retribution or dividing two different races, or one was going to survive and one wasn't going to survive, that does line up with your idea.
The thing about the Land of No Horizon is, if you think of it as a jigsaw puzzle, it's a jigsaw puzzle where all the pieces fit. What we currently have is a jigsaw puzzle that's partly put together in long lines of pieces of jigsaw that are lined up with someone's preconceived idea, but then they can't find the pieces. When you find the true solution to the jigsaw puzzle, not only is it simpler, it's also much smaller and much easier to follow. And we believe in 1680, when they decided the Earth was solid and the center is compressed, We feel it's time to go back and look at this again and look at it seriously because of what we've missed.
But the thing that surprised us as well is, I think we sort of started off with this, is we started off with an initial idea of the Earth being hollow and in order to explain the flood and different things. And as we've gotten into this and we've, you know, started looking at things in a lot more detail, for example, the central sun and fusion and the flipping of the poles and everything, you know, the continental drift and how the continents fit together and place, everything is just falling into place and it's like a network and things correlate across vastly different parts of the idea and we were surprised by that. We didn't really expect it. We thought it would, you know, straight away find things that are not right, and we haven't done that at all. And the problem with the book was really on so many fronts that we were exploring that we just had to stop and write it and get the book out because it's too much. And since we wrote the book, we've actually come up with new ideas and so on as well, and that we're slowly adding and building up this theory, and that's becoming something a lot bigger than we first anticipated.
One thing too, we as Matthew just said, we felt that we were going to find contradictory evidence. We expected it, we went looking for it. We have to find it because if we don't, everyone else will. But we sort of spent 13 years writing the book. We never found anything that contradicted what we felt was correct. All we found was everything contradicting what we currently believe. And the problem is, people believe what we believe just because we've believed it for so long, and it's time that we need to stop and have a look.
Yeah, my good friend Kevin Smith says, the longer you're wrong, the wronger you're wrong.
That is very true. You know, it's a bit like when you're driving along and you don't want to be lost. And someone sitting beside you and saying, you're lost, you're lost. And you say, no, I'm not, I know my way, but you really don't. And the further you go, the more and more embarrassed you get, and the harder it is to get out of the situation.
Well, but we do what science has done. You just kill all the people that say you're lost.
Well, one of the problems with science as well is it's very compartmentalized. So you've got different people focusing on their part of the world or part of whatever they're trying to discover, whether it's genetics or whether it's geology or whatever it is. And what they tend to do is they focus on their bit and rely on everyone else to get that right. And I think the strength of our book is we've looked across all these different areas of science, whether it's genetics and possible origins of humanity and the missing link, or whether it's geology and the drifting continents, and or seismology and magnetic field, that sort of thing. We've looked at all these things, and we've, instead of only looking at one thing and trying to make it fit with what everyone else has done, we actually put everything into question and looked at it all together and then slowly gotten into more detail. And we've found that the pieces fit together in a much more different way and in a much more logical way. And I think that's been the problem so far, is that if someone does question something, they're only questioning one thing and they're still looking at it in the context of all these other things that are wrong. And you can't solve a problem unless you really take a big step back and look at everything in a big picture and really put together the big pieces first. And that's what we've done, and that's what we've put together in this book.
We actually pull the jigsaw to pieces right down to its individual pieces, and then we did not have a preconceived idea. We started putting it together, and we just came up with almost the exact opposite. But, you know, really interesting, just an interesting little thing here is, you know how we're sort of looking into the inner world, and we can see the magnetic field that is creating, that we can see it as a light source inside the Earth. You know, if life did evolve inside the Earth and reach intelligence, you know, they had to discover the outside world. And as we said in the book, just we put this little bit of a story in there, what would they have thought when they found an outside world, not a world of just constant light, but a world of light and day and moving objects. But they would have seen the moon orbiting the Earth, which was their time force inside the Earth that they probably never quite understood.
And the stars.
Yes, of course. And they would never have seen any greater distance than across the width of the expanse. They would not have known how far light travels and things, all that sort of thing, and how truly alone they were. I mean, they may have considered that in their sphere, in a universe of solid magma, they may have gone looking for other spheres in that world. I mean, who knows? When you turn it around, when you look at our situation and turn it around to their situation, they probably had errors like we've got until they discovered that they were locked inside the planet Earth.
Who would have thought that the Earth actually curved the other way?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why our book is called The Land of No Horizon, because as you can imagine, if you're standing inside the planet, the ground gradually turns upwards the further away you look, and you actually would not get a horizon. And if you look across, obviously not directly across because you see the central sun, but if you look across at, say, 45 degrees, you actually see the shapes of continents and the ocean up in the sky.
And
one thing, too, in our book, you've read it, Brooks, we actually take the reader on a journey to the inner Earth as though they've been abducted and they suddenly wake up in this strange place and they're looking around and they don't understand it. And we've actually used all the scientific evidence to describe what you see inside the Earth, the life forms, and all the different things. And that actually is like taking, after people go through our book and we go through all the technical stuff, we take them on a journey to the inner Earth. Obviously, this is an imaginary journey. Obviously, not everything do we know, but we've put together a picture to the best of the evidence that we can. And a lot of our readers have said that they really enjoyed that journey into the Earth.
Yes, I enjoyed that part of the book as well. You might be aware, if you've been to X Squared Radio very often, that in June of next year, we are joining, I am joining an expedition with the Stephen Curry Expedition Company, headed up by Rodney Clough, and we are going to venture out for 21 days on the Russian nuclear icebreaker, the Yamal, and we are going to try to sail through the polar opening into the interior of the Earth. If it's there, we're going to find it. If it's not there, we're going to at least take some decent scientific measurements.
it's probably going to be a lot of things like water temperature measurements, what microbes and things you might find in the water. You may find pollens and things that don't relate to any life form that we know on the outer surface.
Yep.
And they're all going to be great things.
Is there a possibility that a polar hole is submerged and that the ocean completely covers it? And if that's the case, then of course you won't actually be able to sail through a hole, but you will be able to find other types of evidence. I know in the readings that I've done, I've found that sometimes the explorers have found massive areas where there's no ice cover in the middle of winter.
Right.
And they don't understand what that is. And I think that can be easily explained by the excess atmosphere building up inside the planet. It has to escape. And if one of the places that was cut for the flood was over the North Pole, which is a logical place because the geode is low there, then there will be a fault sea floor, and then there's a place where the currents of the ocean can travel through and escape to the outside. And if that is the case, then you may find large areas where there is no ice cover, and you may find unusually strange warm currents, and may even plant life and so on within the water. And I would definitely suggest you take measurements and capture that sort of thing if you can, and really analyze that, because you might find something really amazing.
Well, I'm responsible for doing the headspace analysis of the seawater. I'm on the team that's building a gyroscope. There are 39 other scientists with expertise in various areas, a South African film crew that's coming with us. But I can think of no better addition to the roster than to have one or both of you come with us.
Yeah. The trouble is, Brooks, it's a bit cold up there.
Yeah, they say it gets up to about 20 below zero.
Yeah, it gets up to about 20 below zero.
Yeah, and when
yeah,
we're...
Yeah, it's quite cold.
It's
going to
be summertime.
Yeah.
It's going to be summertime. Come on.
We're going to definitely be watching with interest to find out what sort of things you come back with. And certainly, if you find anything unusual at all, you will want to be the first to know.
Well, you know, we get a lot of feedback. I get a lot of mail on this, and people say, well, the government's never going to let you go. They're going to sink you. They're going to block your transmissions or whatever, not going to allow you to publish. And actually, I was going for
You don't need that because you've got a two-year-old.
Yeah, well, I don't, and Don does. My youngest is 15. But, you know, there are a lot of conspiracy theorists out there that believe the government knows a lot more than what they're sharing with us. And there is some evidence that maybe these beings that live on the interior of the Earth, and there may be multiple races of them, may actually be the source of UFOs on the surface of our planet. So they may have some privacy that they want to maintain. So even they might not let us through. But...
Well, that's it. It may be that if this is true, it may not be your government. It may be your governments are controlled by them. If that is true. But here's another interesting point that I've often brought up with a lot of people. We're sending probes to Mars. We're spending billions and billions of dollars sending probes to Mars to have a look at these floodplains and bring back data. But really, when you think about it, we have enough evidence without walking away from a computer to be able to start a serious calculation study on whether this is feasible or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Matthew and I are. We feel that in our book we are indisputably showing strong evidence to say that we need to look at these things.
That's one of our main goals of the book, really, is to... we're doing a few different things, but we really wanted to take this theory, which up until now has been treated with a lot of skepticism, and we wanted to really show how scientifically credible it is and how many broad areas of science it covers, because it really gets into so many different things. And when you analyse it, there's really a lot of evidence to support it. And I think we really are coming to a point in time now where the people are really wanting to know the answers, and they're not necessarily listening to the government and things like that. They want to find out through other people, and there's a lot of researchers who are getting right into this stuff now, and such as yourself going to the North Pole and so on, and this is exactly what we want. We want people to be taking this further and finding out for themselves, and because really, if all the people want to know, there's no way that anyone can stop it. And I think that's the good thing. We want to really prove that this theory has scientific credibility and it deserves extra attention. And I think we are starting to get that now in a lot of different areas of science.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's, you know, I understand the world of academia, and I know several professors that think a lot of their robes and their awards and their degrees. But I have to tell you, I've been to seminars that have been hosted by universities where multidisciplinary seminars where there have been people, experts from every different area, say in adhesives at a seminar. And if you ask a question just the least little bit off of the pinhead of knowledge that they know, they will defer to someone else. They just don't have the ability of cross thought. And that's one thing that you bring to this discussion. You bring this cross thought, this multidisciplinary viewpoint that this this type of research needs. And I'm not, you know, really worried about some Nobel laureate or some college professor standing there in his underwear because he doesn't have his robes on, because everything that he has based his degree on is has been based on a fable. And now we have, when we walk in front of them and we say, well, the earth is hollow, and you know, everything that they've stood for and that they have professed for over 100 years, or maybe 200 years, is going to be rendered irrelevant.
Yeah, well, one of the things, when we start to explain to people, yes, we Hollow Earth researchers, and we're doing all this writing, and we're writing books and so on, I expect people, when I say that I believe the Earth's hollow, to think I'm a bit crazy, and fair enough, because it is such a different idea to what is currently accepted as being correct out there at the moment.
And well, no more than
you
are saying
why they believe the Earth is solid. They don't actually know why. They don't actually understand what gravity is or how it works. They don't understand that the continents are drifting and how plate tectonics works or anything like that. They believe it because it was told it so.
I can imagine Columbus having this exact same conversation with his crew.
Mm-hmm.
Have you actually failed out there and fallen off the edge of the Earth? No? Okay, then hold your course.
The other thing, too, is when you say, for instance, you take one thing like plate tectonics, some of the theories of why the continents are drifting apart and the plates going underneath one another into subduction zones, they're so horribly flawed that it's almost embarrassing putting it in the book to point out all the flaws. You know, an interesting point is like the ice ages. I mean, you listen to a documentary and they bring up the ice ages, but there's no ice remains in Siberia and northern China. It's only in Europe and America. That is because those continents used to be up on the pole before Earth expansion took place. And so we have been constantly confronted with ideas and theories and thoughts that are hopelessly flawed from day one. Now, if a jigsaw puzzle piece doesn't fit, it either fits or it doesn't. And you can't put a formula onto it and a hammer and push it into place. But this is what seems to be happening because people want their idealistic ideas to be right.
With the ice age, you should probably mention a little bit more about that. There's a few things, that a few bits of evidence that they've found, and they've come to the conclusion that there must have been an ice age. One of the things is glacial evidence at certain parts on the globe that are a long way from the poles. So they thought that, okay, well, if that's the case, then it must have been colder in the past. Another situation is the depth of the ocean. They believe that the ocean was shallower in the past because it was all turned to ice and it was on the continent. But we've quite easily shown how those things have occurred. In the Hollow Earth theory, obviously the flood is what's made the oceans now deeper, and it's Earth expansion that's pushed continents away from polar areas into warmer areas, and this is why there's glacial evidence from the past. And we also mentioned before the erratic boulders that seem to be sitting miles and miles away from their location in the mountains. This has been attributed to glacial action, but this is also it's much better explained by the movement of water from a great flood. So what we've found is that all the questions that have led to the ice age theory have all been solved quite easily by some basic things with the hollow and expanded earth theory.
So you're saying there was no ice age.
Are no longer necessary in order to explain this evidence.
So you're saying there was no ice age.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is if you actually got all the water and evaporated it and turned it to ice on the continent to reduce the ocean level as much as you, much as what should have happened for an ice age, you find it's just totally implausible because ice freezes and expands when it freezes. And there's only a small amount of continents compared to the large amount of ocean. You find that the depth of ice on this continent would be kilometres thick.
The other thing too, Brooks, is this, is if we took 100 feet off 300 million square kilometres, 200 million square kilometres of ocean, and turn it to ice, where does the heat come from in an ice age to evaporate that much water and turn it to ice? Because you can't have ice without heat, because of the precipitation thing. These are where, you know, someone hasn't really thought it through before it's become accepted.
So if we were to take that further, I mean, we've been reading a lot about ice ages, and they say there's plenty of ways that the Earth could turn cold. Now, there could have been dust in the cosmos, and it could have gone between the Earth, and it could have blotted out the sun, and so the Earth turned cold. There's a whole range of different possibilities. It could have been a celestial impact that's actually brought dust into the atmosphere. And we're not denying any of these things could possibly happen, but the thing is, if you plunge the Earth into darkness, which means you don't have the sun, you will not have an ice age, because you all of a sudden will not have any precipitation, because you don't have any evaporation, because the heat is gone, so you cannot have ice forming on the continent and creating these huge ice sheets, because there's no heat there to do it.
Right.
And so the actual basic premise of the ice age is just flawed in that regard anyway. And I think what we've come up with the idea of the flood and Earth expansion as explaining some of these other aspects of the evidence, it fits much more credibly and simply, and that's really what we're trying to say.
I can see regional ice, forming. For instance, last year we had a number of very bad hurricanes in our area. Had they occurred, say, 3 months later and a couple of hundred miles north, they would have dumped maybe a third of the United States would have been under 6 to 8 feet of snow. That much reflection of heat back out into space would probably lower the temperature of the planet maybe a half a degree or a quarter of a degree. But eventually, within 20 or 25 years, that snow would melt off.
Yeah.
That's not
we're talking about kilometers of snow. Feet,
right, yeah, that's
which is
not
really
feasible.
Such a huge difference to 8 feet of snow. And so we're not denying that any of these things happen, they obviously do, but the sheer volumes that we're talking about make it unworkable. And that's the problem they've always had with this theory. Yeah. And if you actually read the people that have put forward these proposals, they actually tell you what the problems with their own theory are. But what happens is the general community tend to latch onto these things and then treat them as fact, and you'll have them in textbooks, and you you read about the impact of being responsible for the dinosaurs extinction and that sort of thing. Whereas all of these theories, they're only theories, and the people that propose them actually give you a list of the things that they're still trying to work on and so on. And unfortunately, someone just takes all that out and says, this is what's so, and then we believe it. And, of course, once people believe something, it takes a mountain of evidence to convince someone otherwise. Because we like to believe that we're right. We don't like to be proved wrong.
Brooks, one thing that's interesting, too, is coal. They found coal in Antarctica, so they thought, well, it must have been once warm. It must have supported the forests. And so then they had theories about the Earth rolling over in space, and they tied this in with the reversing magnetic field. But in actual fact, if you look at a forest that's been growing in America for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, and you dig underneath that forest, you're not going to find coal, you only find soil. The only reason why coal is formed is after a cataclysmic event, which may be an inundation event, which sweeps the forests off continents and takes them great distances. And some of the coal seams require 3,000 feet of timber to make. And also, in the coal is all these different marine layers, and there's bits of coral, and there's deep sea creatures, and then there's species from all over the world, all different climates in one place. And what seems to happen in a lot of cases is decisions are made too quickly without properly analysing how is coal formed. And the coal in Antarctica could have been swept there by a great flood, or it could have been swept there by a cataclysmic impact or something like that. It's a bit like the mammoth they found up near the northern Arctic region with grasses in its mouth from further south. When you get a cataclysmic event, We've got tidal waves miles high crossing continents and sweeping everything off it, taking it great distances and dumping it at the poles or furthest away from where the impact occurred or where the flood occurred.
So basically what's happening is you've got all of these different life forms and different plants and animals from different parts of the world all in one coal seam. Now, it's interdispersed with marine deposits. So you really have to analyze this for what it is and really see it as a global event or a very large-scale event. You can't create coal in any other way. And
I
so
always
when
wondered about that. Here in Western Kentucky, we have a lot of coal. I mean, there are 10 coal mines within 20 miles drive of where I live. And I know a lot of miners, and they bring up the strangest things from these coal
mines. That's right. Well, we can't forget how coal is formed. It's not a gradual process. It's just from a cataclysmic event. And whether this was from a long time ago when the Earth was smaller, even an impact from the Great Bombardment, that's obviously going to form coal and oil deposits and so on. And that's why we have so much of it, because the Earth has been producing forests and life for such a long time, and it just keeps getting wiped out and dumped and buried and we're finding all this in the coal and oil deposits as we've been
mining. We tend to think the changes in the Earth have been gradual over millions of years, but I think we've got to think differently. We've got to think what the Earth has been exposed to, and a lot of the major changes that have occurred in the Earth, like we're talking about the Grand Canyon before. Grand Canyon could be formed in one day or 2 days. And I think we've got to think that way. We've got to think of what the Earth is exposed to, not this gradual grain by grain is washed out each time it rains in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah. You know, there's enough evidence to support that. September of last year, there was a geological team that flew into the a region called the Afar Triangle. And as the helicopter landed and the team got out, some of them were students, I think, and a couple of professors, the earth began to tremble. And the vibration was so violent that the helicopter pilot asked them to get back in the helicopter, and they took off.
Wow.
Well, as they took off, they looked out over the desert floor where they were at, and the ground was unzipping as this huge crack opened up. And during the time that they were watching, this sunk about 100 feet, and over the next couple of months, it actually sunk about 100 meters. And it is beginning to fill in with the Dead Sea. So the interesting thing that they wrote in their article was, here they were, you know, geological students, and they were going to write about or study about changes that occur over millions of years. And here they see literally 1,000 yards of ground rip open in just a couple of minutes before them. And now it's filling in with ocean. And if they hadn't seen it happen, they would have thought that occurred over millions of years as well.
That's right, exactly. You know, another thing that we haven't actually covered, we've probably got a few minutes left, is craters on planets. The Mare Oriental on the Moon and the Polaris Basin on Mercury are large craters. And if they were solid planets, why is the floor of those craters following the curvature of the planet and in effect, topographically, higher than the walls of the crater?
Well, that's interesting.
Because what happens is, as an impact occurs with a hollow planet, the planetary shell deflects inwards.
And the deflection inwards actually takes some of the impact force. So we find that depending on the size of the impact, we have a different shape to that impact. So if you have a small impact, it has a classic bowl-shaped structure.
Mm-hmm.
If we have a larger impact, we start to get a central peak in the center of the crater. And what that is formed by, it's from a rebounding of the outer shell, throwing up a central point. And if we go larger still, I mean, to talk about some of these massive craters like the ones that I just mentioned, they're so large that they're actually convex, and they're all craters like six bullseyes. And what's actually happened is the impact has deflected the wall in for quite a substantial amount, and it's then risen up and down like a bit like a drop of water.
It bounced back with gravity.
That's right.
And this is another explanation.
But basically, the structure of a crater after the event indicates what sort of structure is underneath, what the structure of the planet is like. Now, if we had a completely solid planet, we would not see the same sort of impact craters. we would find that it would actually create a ball shape no matter how big the crater was. And then this might be filled up with volcanism and so on. We wouldn't see the cracked shapes of the impact at the surface because it's risen back up. And this is quite a fascinating thing. Of course, we see this more on the planets in the solar system that don't have an atmosphere and don't have ocean, because obviously that has taken away a lot of the evidence through erosion and so on the Earth. But certainly on the Moon and on Mars and also on Mercury, we see this same pattern of craters forming all the time.
Mm. And I think recently, too, there have been some photographs published of not really volcanic activity on the Moon, but some kind of vapor escaping from the surface and ejecting up into the vacuum, and then, of course, quickly disappearing. But the fact that that something in the Moon is coming out is pretty
interesting. Well, the Moon has to be hollow as well, for a start, because of its size. And therefore, any outgassing that occurred on the outside, which has been blown away, would be trapped inside the Moon. Mm-hmm. So it would have an atmosphere inside, because it's a volcanic mass, and volcanic mass emits gases. And so there would be, the Moon is hollow, there would be atmosphere inside the Moon. So therefore, if there was an impact that fractured the shell of the Moon, then you could expect that sort of thing. I mean, it may even be ice on the inside surface, because there's no magnetic field to measure inside the Moon, there probably is no heat in there. So there might be ice on the inside surface. When the impact has taken place, it cracks the surface and the atmosphere has escaped and forced ice crystals out, and this is what we've probably seen.
If the pressure is still growing inside the Moon as well, this escape of atmosphere could occur without an impact. It might just suddenly breach the wall and escape, and this is
exactly
what we could be seeing. It may not require an impact, of course, as well.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, I know one thing we have done tonight is we have built the curiosity of millions of people that are listening live and that will listen to this archive about this book, The Land of No Horizon, by Kevin and Matthew Taylor. You can get it by going to their website, which is hollowearththeory.com, or you can go to X Squared Radio, go to the archives, and we have a link to the book there as well. And as soon as BBS Radio and X Squared Radio get their archives up, you can listen to those. And if I can talk one or both of these gentlemen into joining us next year, maybe we'll go to the hollow Earth, or at least close to it, and try to get some measurements. One thing is for sure, we're going to figure out a way to get this information out to you on an hourly or even a daily basis from that expedition. So if anything happens to the ship, and I do understand the seas get as high as about 12 stories, but this boat is quite capable. In fact, I think it's the only civilian ship on the planet capable of making this trip. It's nuclear-powered. It'll carry 74 of us. It has a helicopter on it. It has another boat on it. And if I can talk them into it, we'll try to put a mini-sub on it so that we can get some subsurface water measurements for oxygenation and things like that. There's a lot of evidence we're going to try to collect. And hopefully, maybe, if Kevin and Matthew Taylor write another book, maybe it will be a textbook that will be used in universities around the world to teach an alternate view of the construction of the Earth.
One of the things we'd like to encourage as well is for other people to have their spin on things as well. I mean, we're only just two people, and we've uncovered so much stuff. And I think because this is such a crazy idea to most people, that's actually been a blessing to us, because we've been able to explore and research all of this stuff in isolation without anyone beating us to it. And but now the floodgates are open a little bit, and we're finding all sorts of people who are getting on the bandwagon and are finding things for themselves. And we expect other people to find and make other discoveries that we haven't thought of, because it just covers so many topics. It's just so much that people can get into more detail than we are. We can, as just two people.
We need lots of research in areas that we just can't cover, because we're spread pretty thin on this. And that's why Matthew's more into the science side of thing, and I'm onto more the other side of thing, because that way we can cover a larger area together.
That's exactly right. Well, I nominate you both for the Nobel Prize.
Thank you.
And at the moment, we are discussing exactly what we've been discussing last night till nearly midnight. We're discussing our next book,
which will be more of a technical science nature, like the cornerstone of the Hollow Earth theory. And we're not quite sure how long that'll be. Matthew and I live in different states, but we hope to be able to put something together and follow up this book with perhaps a couple of new books eventually.
But of course, our current book is still really across all of these things, and what we're hoping to do with the second book is just really put a bit more detail in some areas. But you'll find that our current book it covers such a lot of stuff, you'll be amazed really when you go through it all.
It's a good book.
Right.
One thing just very quick I'd like to say about the book. The book is written in ordinary, everyday language that ordinary people can understand. It's not written in the kind of way for scientists. It's written for everyone. So we haven't used a lot of technical terminology. We've used a lot of diagrams, simple text. This way, anyone can pick up our book, read it, and understand it. You don't have to have a science degree. Because we really want to get this message out to everyone, not just to one or two people. We want everyone to understand it. And perhaps if a great number of people
are there. You did a good job of it. The book is very well written. I think it's a good read. It's not too technical, but there's enough meat and potatoes in there for someone like me that I can grab enough out of it. And those of you that like a good story or like the more artistic viewpoint of the center of the earth, that's in there as well. We're at the end of our broadcast time. I do want to thank both of you for being on the program. It's been a total pleasure.
Thank you for inviting us.
Even with the technical difficulties we had in the second hour, it worked out just fine. And I appreciate both of you being on, and I'll let you get on with your day.
Thank you very much. It's been
a
pleasure.
Same here. Well, Earth Explorers, don't forget that our live broadcast from Trout Lake in Washington State during the Science, Spirit, and World Transformation Conference on August 20th. We'll see you there, and I will play my exit.